Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. Democratic candidates for president each made their first big pitch to the public this week over two nights of fiery debate.
This is not about policy. This is personal.
Necesitamos incluir.
Do you have a plan to deal with Mitch McConnell?
I do.
Because I couldn't get it done.
Yes, they will pay more in taxes, but less in health care.
And that little girl was me.
Anyway, my time's up.
The Supreme Court delivered major decisions involving the rules that help govern our democracy, partisan gerrymandering, and the census. Yesterday, New York State Attorney General Letitia James celebrated the court's decision to block the Trump administration from adding a citizenship question to the census, at least for now.
Every single person in this country deserves to be counted, plain and simple. And today, thanks to the Supreme Court's decision, we will have an opportunity to do just that.
And a photo of a migrant father and daughter from El Salvador who drowned trying to cross into America captured the perils of migration and the outrage of the nation. The image stirred this response from Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson, the Republican chairman of the Homeland Security Committee that oversees border matters.
Oscar Alberto Martinez Ramirez and his 23-month-old daughter, Valeria. Now, I realize tragedies occur all over this country. All over the world. I don't want to see another picture like that on the U.S. border.
Join us. Who captured your interest at the debates or caused you to switch allegiances? What answers surprised you? What conversations have you been having since? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. With us from Miami, Florida, is Ginger Gibson. She's national political correspondent from Reuters. She's in Miami this week covering the Democratic presidential debates, no doubt has had a crazy week. Ginger, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me back.
And with us from Washington, D.C. is Pierre Thomas. He's chief justice correspondent for ABC News. Busy times for you, Pierre. So glad you can join us once more.
Hello. Good to be with you.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, David, Ginger, and Pierre.
So let's start with, you know, the second debate first. A lot of energy, I thought. Ginger Gibson, what did we learn last night from the second Democratic debate?
I think we learned a lot about the candidates and how they are going to interact with one another. Everyone thought going into tonight that this was going to be the Biden v. Bernie show. Instead, it was Kamala Harris who really emerged as the candidate willing to take the swings at Biden and to land punches. We also saw some vulnerability from the former vice president. He struggled to respond to Harris. Now, that doesn't mean he had a totally bad night.
Yeah, Ginger, let me play a clip and then let you talk a little bit more about that. In last night's debate, Harris, the California senator, she targeted Biden, and it was over his record about federally mandated efforts to integrate public schools back 40 years ago, that is in the 1970s. Here's part of what that exchange sounded like.
Do you agree today that you were wrong to oppose busing in America then?
No.
Do you agree?
I did not oppose busing in America. What I opposed is busing ordered by the Department of Education. That's what I opposed.
Well,
I
there
did
was
not
a failure of states to integrate public schools in America. I was part of the second class to integrate Berkeley, California public schools almost two decades after Brown v. Board of Education.
Because your city council made that decision. It was a
local
decision.
So that's where the federal government must step in.
So, Ginger, what was the import of that?
The import was that Harris really went after him on an issue about race, and he couldn't answer it. You know, Delaware, the vice president's home state, had a very complicated busing system. I, decades after Kamala Harris, rode the bus in the bus system in Delaware. And Biden really couldn't explain his opposition. He couldn't and didn't take the other route to say, you know what, you're right. That was the 1970s. That was the 1980s, and I was wrong then. It really was a moment that showed where he is vulnerable. And as I was, you know, want to make clear, though, it wasn't that Biden had just a terrible night. He had earlier in the debate kind of taken one from Eric Swalwell, the congressman from California. He had several other moments where he really sort of stood out. But that exchange will really be the one that probably most affects his campaign going forward.
Pierre Thomas, you've covered Washington politics for a long time. Eric Swalwell, Democratic congressman from California, did talk about it. It was kind of amazing. I wasn't sure where he was going to go with it, but he did say, you know, as a young man, I watched a senator, handsome senator, come in and talk about – I was 8 years old. He came to the state party and he talked about the importance of passing a torch to a new generation. And I thought he's way too young to have heard John Kennedy, right? But it turned out he said that was Joe Biden and it is time for the torch to be passed. Later on, Bernie Sanders said this was kind of ageism, that they were trying to ice out, I guess, the septuagenarian set up there. What about the generational tension that you're seeing between perhaps a new and in some ways less known crop of candidates and some of these folks who have been around Washington for a very long time?
You know, it was blatant, and I thought very interesting. It's clear that Swalwell wants to paint Biden basically as too old for the job, and he all but said that. We're in a situation where Biden is pushing back, saying that it's the ideas, and you heard Bernie Sanders join him saying it's not the age but the ideas. But one thing I did want to say, just going back to the issue of race for
Please.
1 second, what Kamala Harris did was seem to put Biden in a position of supporting sort of states' rights.
Right.
Because part of the issue is that states should have control over certain issues. And Kamala Harris really was hitting hard on this notion that there are moments when local governments, state governments, are not doing the right things by minorities, and it's the federal government that has to step in. And it's going to be interesting to see how particularly the African-American community views Biden. Was it just – will they view it as – and it's not a monolithic group, obviously, but will many in the black community view that as just a misstep by Biden, or will they think that, oh, perhaps he is a little out of step and we cannot look at him, many might say, just because he was the vice president to the first African-American president.
And Pierre, briefly, I mean, it's one of these things where busing in the American population at large is not necessarily a terribly popular thing right now. And at the same time, the idea of defending states' rights did echo some of those senators that he had praised, it seemed, not so long ago and not so many weeks ago, and talking about guys that he had to work with to get things done, and yet who represent in some ways American segregationist and shameful past.
Well, you know, race in this country remains that touchstone issue, that issue that frays the minds of many and the emotions of many. And again, you have to look at it from multiple points of view. There will be many minorities that will say that, look, the communities and the schools that some of them had access to were not as good as the schools that they could get access to through busing. And that's what the point that Kamala Harris seemed to be making. Obviously, Biden pushed forth the notion that he's been a fighter for civil rights over and over throughout his career, that no one can say otherwise. But again, it was a moment in that debate that was palpable.
Wanted to move Jack Beatty to a question that has become surfaced a lot on the campaign trail. Moderators asked all the Democratic candidates whether they would abolish private health insurance. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren on Wednesday night raised her hand and said she would, and that the business models of private insurance companies require families to face rising premiums as they try to fight for the health care they need. And then she made her pitch.
Medicare for all solves that problem. And I understand there are a lot of politicians who say, oh, it's just not possible. We just can't do it. It's have a lot of political reasons for this. What they're really telling you is they just won't fight for it.
Jack, to what extent is this becoming the default position for Democratic candidates who are being taken seriously on the presidential trail?
Well, it was a position that only that Elizabeth Warren shared only with two other candidates, Bernie Sanders and Senator Harris. So it's not the default position, and it's it is the most risky position I think any candidate has taken looking toward a general election, consider some of the statistics that David Brooks cites today. He says only there's a poll showing that only 13% of Americans, only 13% would approve of a health system with no private plans. That's what Bernie wants. That appears to be what Senator Harris wants. 70% of Americans are happy with their private insurance. A Democratic platform with single payer in it, with abolishing private insurance, the data suggests that would be a suicide note to the American electorate. And I heard a Republican consultant say, we will spend $500 million nailing the Democrats on that issue and giving the President Trump a tremendous advantage.
And Jack, before the end of this segment and talking about this debate, I don't want to let go of a moment that I thought was pretty striking. South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg had returned from the campaign trail home to address racial tensions in recent days. In last night's debate, MSNBC's Rachel Maddow asked Buttigieg why his police force is disproportionately white in a city that's about a quarter African American.
Because I couldn't get it done. My community is in anguish right now because of an officer-involved shooting, a black man, Eric Logan, killed by a white officer. And I'm not allowed to take sides until the investigation comes back. The officer said he was attacked with a knife, but he didn't have his body camera on. It's a mess, and we're hurting.
Jack Beatty, briefly, what did you make of that moment?
That was a moment of rare grace. We don't hear that from our politicians. They make mistakes like the rest of us. They never admit them. Mr. Trump, notably, but not just him. President Obama, I was loath to say he did anything wrong. So that really, I think, showed his, if you will, his moral timber, that this is a man of a nuanced look at the world, who's willing to admit problems, and the only way you can solve them is to admit that you have a problem and then deal with it.
And as Pierre noted earlier, the way in which race remains an element in our debates, and also notable in the reflection of the kinds of candidates we saw on stage on Wednesday and Thursday evenings. We're talking about our week's top news stories. We want our guests, Ginger Gibson, Pierre Thomas, Jack Beatty, to hold. We want all of you to hold. Coming up, we'll take a look at the Supreme Court's two major decisions this week, the latest on immigration. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're going behind the headlines with our Week in the News Roundtable. You can join our conversation. What's your reaction to the decisions from the country's highest court on gerrymandering and on the census? What do you want to hear from Special Counsel Robert Mueller during his testimony before the House? Follow us on the Twitters and the Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm speaking with Ginger Gibson. She's national political correspondent for Reuters. Pierre Thomas, he's chief justice correspondent for ABC News. And Jack Beatty, our own news analyst here at On Point. We were talking a few moments ago about the question of Medicare. Kamala Harris had raised her hand saying she supported getting rid of private health insurance, and then it indicated subsequently that she thought she'd been asked about whether she'd be willing to get rid of her own to be on Medicare. She said today on CBS This Morning, quote, I'm in support of Medicare for all, and under a Medicare for all policy, private insurance would certainly exist for supplemental coverage. We would actually extend benefits, for example, vision care, dental care, hearing aids, which currently are not covered. I want to take a few calls from folks from our listeners in Lexington, Massachusetts. We have a call from David. David, go ahead. Tell us your thoughts.
Thank you, and hello to you, David and Jack. I'm a left-wing Democrat, and I'll vote for the eventual nominee no matter who it is. I just want to Trump the hell out of the White House. That said, when the Democrats jumped all over each other to say that they would decriminalize illegal immigration, my heart sank. An Axios poll last year of likely midterm voters found that 80% of think that illegal immigration is a problem, echoing a Harvard-Harris poll earlier that year. The audience cheering didn't mitigate my fears. I'm sure those were all elite Democrats, and I doubt there were any Rust Belt Democrats in that audience.
And David, let me ask you very quickly before we relinquish you, is that how you personally fear, or are you articulating your anxieties because you're worried about the larger population?
Both.
Okay, terrific. Really appreciate your working with us on that. Thank you, David. I want to play a clip now from Wednesday night. Two Texas Democrats on stage sparred over the issue of immigration that David just raised, particularly the part of the U.S. Code that makes crossing the border a criminal offense and not a civil one. Former Housing and Urban Development Secretary Julian Castro said the Trump administration is using that section to incarcerate parents and to separate families. He criticized one of his rivals, former Congressman Beto O'Rourke, for failing to push for that section's repeal.
I think it's a mistake, and I think that if you truly want to change the system, then we got to repeal that section. If not,
thank you.
Then it might as well be the same policy.
Let me respond to this very briefly. Actually, as a member of Congress, I helped to introduce legislation that would ensure that we don't criminalize those who are seeking asylum and refuge in this country. If you're fleeing desperation, I want to make sure that you're treated with respect.
I'm still talking about everybody else.
But you're looking at just one small part of this. I'm talking about a comprehensive rewrite of our immigration
laws.
That's
not true.
So O'Rourke, who was saying that he was talking about a comprehensive rewrite, told CNN earlier this month he did not want to repeal that very section, and he cited attempts by some crossing the border to smuggle people or drugs into the United States. I want to take a call now from Mark, who's calling from Appleton, Wisconsin. How does it look from out there, Mark?
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
Actually, I was going to talk about the immigration bill that passed.
Okay. That passed Congress. Okay. We're gonna talk about that in a minute or two, but why don't you go ahead?
Okay. I just wanted to point out that under Republican leadership, that would not have even been brought to the floor of the House because they were working under the Hastert rule, something that doesn't get enough attention, I think, because it gave the Freedom Caucus veto power. That's why we didn't have comprehensive immigration reform in 2013.
Mark, just to pause for a second for our listeners, yep. The Hastert rule is such that you don't bring up a bill unless a majority of your own party, I think, wants to pass it. Is that right?
Exactly, which basically means that you have no interest in bipartisanship. And my understanding is that the immigration bill that was passed, this emergency aid that's desperately needed, was passed with a minority of Democrats. And it's a great thing that the House functioned the way the founders expected it to function, which is a majority of the House, not simply a majority of the ruling party.
All right, Mark. Well, thank you for that call. Appreciate it. Why don't we turn to that then, Ginger Gibson? Let's talk a little bit for a minute about the immigration bill that was passed. The House had passed a bill that included a lot of funding to address a lot of concerns of from critics of the administration, the way they'd handled migrants, people applying for asylum, people who have been detained at the border without legal status in this country coming from south of the border. But ultimately, the House passed the Senate bill that more narrowly offered a fair amount of funds to these various agencies dealing with these things without some of those restrictions and extra riders. What happened up there, Ginger?
I think first we can be reminded that candidates can get on a debate stage and talk about hypotheticals, and the real world of governing can keep happening around them, and the conditions are changing. Let's start with Nancy Pelosi. Nancy Pelosi has returned or obtained position of sort of a liberal fan. You know, she's their leader, but her ability to fight with the president has really gotten her a lot of accolades. But at her core, she is a pragmatist. She is a person who understands that government has to keep working and that she has to get bills passed. And we saw that this week in her chamber. It is not a perfect bill. It is not a bill that made her liberal flank very happy. And I think that pointing out the Hastert rule, which is a very inside D.C. thing, is a great point. She's not ruling like Paul Ryan or John Boehner did over that chamber. She is moving legislation in a way that isn't perfect. And for that reason, this legislation would do some of the things that Democrats wanted and would do some things that maybe they didn't. I think that what we're going to see is a real test of Washington, and maybe the only test that will be conducted before we get to November of next year, of can they get it across the finish line? Can they find real bicameral agreements going forward?
Immigration lawyer Elora Mukherjee visited the Border Patrol Detention Center in Clinton, Texas last week. She described the conditions at the facility to my colleague Meghna Chakrabarty on Tuesday.
We saw children who were hungry, who were dirty, who were sick, and who were terrified and who have been detained for days and weeks and some nearly a month. The children consistently reported that they did not have enough food to eat. The children were dirty. Most of them had not showered since crossing the border.
Pierre Thomas, not so many days ago, Vice President Pence gave an interview to Jake Tapper on CNN in which Tapper kind of pressed him to say, hey, why is it that these kids don't have toothbrushes? Why are these kids don't have pillows? Like, what's going on down there that these – not only are we detaining them in this way, but we're not even giving them the most fundamental human needs? And Pence said, gosh, if only Congress would act, all this would be different. He really didn't indicate that even that minimal amount of expenditure was possible prior to that. This bill has now been passed. The Senate bill embraced. What confidence is there that the kinds of conditions that Mukherjee described to Meghna earlier this week will ease and eventually evaporate, even if people continue to be detained?
It's unclear. Clearly, the immigration issue and that southern border is a vexing issue. You have increasing numbers of families coming to the border, trying to get across. And, you know, with the numbers, the immigration officials and border officials have been saying that they've been overwhelmed. I think the question that the American public is going to ask is, okay, the people show up. Can you not provide the basics, toothbrush, enough food, medical attention? And I think the answer to that question is a bit of an unknown. The press gets some access to these facilities. The description by the attorney is harrowing. But then when the press is taken into some of these facilities, it does not appear to be that bad. I think, unfortunately, where we are in this country is that everything is viewed through a partisan lens, and it's hard to get to the facts and get to what the daily reality is.
Jack Beatty, before we return to Pierre's sweet spot in the Supreme Court, which had its own ferment this week, I wanted to repeat and reiterate one of the things that happened with photographs surfaced, I believe, in the Mexican press first and then, of course, in this country, of Oscar Alberto Martinez Ramirez and his 23-month-old daughter, Valeria, who drowned trying to make it into this country. And their bodies were flown back to El Salvador. The Salvadoran president, Nayib Bukele, I believe, flew those bodies back at the state's expense. And he said, someday we will finish building a country where these things do not happen. Someday we will finish building a country where migration is an option and not an obligation. In the meantime, we will do as much as we can. God help us. It had been part, Jack Beatty, of, if I recall correctly, Obama administration's efforts on this to help to subsidize certain kinds of development in Central American countries in particular, to try to help ease the economic strains and tensions down there. What likelihood is there that somehow some of that would emerge from Congress as it grapples with this issue beyond, of course, what it passed earlier this week?
Well, of course, President Trump has threatened to rescind funding for these sending countries in the Northern Corps. So that would be just the wrong way to go. Beto O'Rourke has talked about a Marshall Plan of some billions of dollars to aid civil society groups in these countries to make them more habitable. The trouble is, of course, that the governments are shot through with corruption. And one of the candidates last night, I forget, said we need to have a sort of hemispheric conference. I think it was Senator Bennett. Bring together the leaders of these countries in Washington, have them say what they need, and see if we can deal with it at the before the problem comes to our border.
Pierre Thomas, big week on the Supreme Court. Two major issues in which seemingly one handed down that will please liberal critics of the president, one that will benefit both parties in certain instances, but in particular the Republican Party. Tell us a little bit. First, let's start with the census question. There's the question of whether the question about citizenship can be added to the census. Tell us how it was resolved and why it matters.
Well, the court ruled that the administration offered no credible reason for adding the question. And you had Justice Roberts providing the swing vote on that issue. And it's, again, part of this debate about the demographics of society. The progressives, liberals say that, you know, everyone should be counted. It's really, at the end of the day, about money flow in terms of how much money's how many dollar states get in terms of federal dollars. So it has significant repercussions. The other issue that you were referring to involves this issue of gerrymandering, in which political figures, state legislators can basically design congressional districts in a way that are to the advantage of a particular party. The Supreme Court ruled that that process pretty much can go forward as it is. Conservatives saw that as a big victory. Progressives were angry about that. Again, Justice Roberts played a critical role in being that swing vote.
Pierre, very briefly, one of the things that struck me about the census ruling, which does affect, as you say, funding, like how much money there is, because the census, the enumeration clause of the Constitution basically says, you know, this is how we can apportion money for how many people, also affects how many people are seen as allocated, I guess, in certain districting. But it was a way in which the Chief Justice defined this was said, guys, you haven't given me a peg to hang my hat on in a legitimate way. He didn't seem to be particularly opposed to the argument. He said, you guys seem to have fundamentally misrepresented or lied about your motivations all along, and that's not good for the legitimacy of the court here. Am I misreading that?
No, I think you're right. I mean, I don't think the issue was completely resolved. But what the court said in that ruling, though, is clear. Again, you offered no credible reason for adding the question. You haven't come up with a rationale for why you want to add this question. And I think that raises the whole question, is was it done purely for political reasons? There's a lot of reporting out there about how this came to be in terms of the administration's stance on this. So you're very much on point, excuse the pun, that was the issue.
And Jack Beatty, this was a case that involved Republicans in one state, Democrats in Maryland, which is a state that I used to cover politics in. And yet it seems to be a little asymmetrical in terms of which party is aggressively pursuing this tactic. What did you make of what you read about the gerrymandering decision?
Well, you know, I think the Roberts Court in Citizens United essentially greenlighted the systemic corruption of American politics and validated the golden rule. He who has the gold rules. And in this decision, the gerrymandering decision, they greenlighted anti-democracy, minority rule. What could be more undemocratic than a system in which the politicians choose the voters rather than the other way about? This was a bad day for the court, and it follows on with a chain of decisions that seem to say, not only the court but throughout the Republican Party, that seem to validate the generalization of David Frum early on in the Trump administration, where he said, you know, if conservatives have to choose between democracy and conservatism, they may well choose conservatism over democracy. And conservatism here won, if conservatism defined as minority rule.
the case was decided about partisan gerrymandering, but nonetheless, a number of civil rights groups fought against the efforts of state officials to be able to design it in that way. Here's Sheila Isong of the NAACP outside of the Supreme Court yesterday reacting to the court's decision to permit partisan gerrymandering.
We lost today in gerrymandering. What we know is that that's going to pack the courts. We know that we're giving elected officials who are directly affected by a line, we're giving them the power to draw their own lines and essentially create their own districts. We know that that's going to hurt some of our community members, but we're not going to give up the fight.
Pierre Thomas, in the 30 seconds we have left, how legitimate are the concerns that this partisan line drawing will affect people, by race through less direct and less explicit means?
Well, many in the minority community believe that this has been used primarily by Republicans to, again, shape districts in which their voters are more at play than voters that represent minority communities. And in that way, they feel they are hurt. So the question now is, will Democrats in states that they control pursue the same thing?
Two little line items just breaking today. The Supreme Court announced it'll take up next term whether the Trump administration illegally tried to end DACA, the program that shields from deportation young undocumented immigrants brought to the U.S. as children. And the Supreme Court will not revive Alabama's ban on the most commonly used procedure in second trimester abortions. We want you to hold on. We're going to talk about the week's top news stories remaining, a look at President Trump on the world stage, tensions with Iran. I'm David Folkenflik. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. You're hearing the strains of a song called On Point. Catchy tune, catchy title. It's an original song written by Cam Jackson and performed by Trottier Middle School's Big Band. Cam just finished up the eighth grade in Southborough, Massachusetts. He told us this song popped into his head while he was mowing the lawn and listening to On Point. Thanks for listening and sharing your musical inspiration with us, Cam. And thanks to Trottier Middle School's Big Band. We're continuing to do a deep dive into this week's top stories. You can join the conversation. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm speaking with Ginger Gibson. She's national political correspondent for Reuters. Pierre Thomas, chief justice correspondent for ABC News. And, of course, Jack Beattie, our own news analyst here at On Point. I wanted to get to the something that has not yet happened. It was announced this week that Robert Mueller, the now former special prosecutor on all matters Trump and Russia, will testify in mid-July in front of two House committees and take questions. Republicans who had been praising him have slightly changed their tune. They'd praised him to use his report to claim that the president had been exonerated. Republican Representative Mark Meadows of North Carolina, for example, chairs the highly conservative House Freedom Caucus. He spoke on Fox News Tuesday in response to the news that that Mueller will testify before Congress in July.
Bob Mueller better be prepared, because I can tell you he will be cross-examined for the first time, and the American people will start to see the flaws in his report.
Ginger Gibson, what's the importance of Mueller speaking in front of Congress instead of having his report read by the public more broadly?
Well, his report was 400 pages. And while I've read 400 pages of it, and a handful of your readers have probably read 400 pages of it, maybe on the beach.
George Stephanopoulos informed us he read it as well this weekend, right?
Most people have not read the 400 pages of Robert Mueller's report, as compellingly written as it is. This is going to be a time when he has to get in front of a microphone, in front of cameras and explain the things that are in there. And that is much more compelling than a 400-page report. Democrats have known that the way to get Americans to pay attention and to really understand what was in there was to get him in front of a camera. And there's a lot of details. There's a lot of scenes. There's a lot of background in Mueller's report. What there isn't a lot of is conclusions or recommendations. And he's sort of said why, but he's going to have to deal with a lot of questions from Democrats justifying that. And they're going to be trying everything they can to try to push him to say something more about what he would have concluded had he been a little bit looser with those conclusions.
He said that he would stay within sort of the four corners of what he put out in his report and his relatively brief remarks before the press when he issued it, or I guess not when he issued it, but later in responding in some ways to the Justice Department's comments on it. Is there expectation on the Hill that they'll be able to pry more out, or is it just literally by having somebody with clips that will be replayed on television, the power of video taught us over and over again, accomplishing more than something on the written page, that that in and of itself is going to do something for Democrats and help illuminate what his conclusions were, even if the substance of what he's saying isn't any different?
Have no doubt there are members of Congress who believe they are brilliant questioners and that they could get anyone to say something if they tried hard enough. But I don't know if that's going to be the case. Mueller is trained at testifying, at answering questions about dealing with tense and combative situations. I would be surprised if he let something out that he hadn't let out before. But part of that is about holding on to his credibility. If he gets up there and he doesn't bend to every question, if he doesn't lose his temper as the Jim Jordans of the world try to cross-examine him, as he put it, then that could boost his credibility. The American public says, look, he's not a partisan guy. He's just telling us what he knows. But I don't think we can underestimate how much Democrats think the image of him sitting in a hearing room, of him testifying in a very sober tone, will help it translate and really reach the American public to get them to understand what is inside this report.
Over the weekend, Ginger, allegations of a non-Russian type resurfaced. The writer and journalist E. Jean Carroll published a piece in New York Magazine about various encounters she had had with men who behaved badly, in some cases quite badly, toward her, as she wrote about it. One of them involved allegations about President Trump. On Monday, she sat down with CNN's Allison Camerota, and she retold her allegation that the president sexually assaulted her in a shopping store dressing room 23 years ago.
He denies it. He turns it around. He attacks and he threatens. That is the and then everybody forgets it. And then the next woman comes along, and I am sick of it. I am sick of it. Think how many women have come forward. Nothing happens. The only thing we can do is sit with you and tell our stories so that we empower other women to come forward and tell their stories, because we have to change this culture of sexual violence.
Ginger, how did this was this story received in Trump world and in terms of the seriousness of what was alleged here?
Well, we had the truly sort of mind-boggling response from the president in which he deflected these accusations by asserting that she wasn't his type, drew a lot of criticism from the left. But inside Trump's orbit, among the people who are trying to get him reelected, they really think that none of this can hurt him anymore, that it's all baked in, that any voter that was going to be outraged by the accusations have already been outraged, and they're not going to lose another one. I have to say, I'm not sure they're right. I go out and I talk to voters across America, and there's an exhaustion. There's an exhaustion even among people who voted for him about the scandal and the outrage and the angry tweets in the middle of the night and the barely winking at Putin that we maybe saw this week. I think that there is some sense among voters that it's just too much, and that they are beginning to believe that something else is afoot here, and that while his most strident and his supporters and the people who back him aren't going to be swayed, there is some fatigue setting in, maybe a little buyer's remorse about some of the independents out there.
Pierre Thomas, before we move on to international matters affecting the country, you know, I do think we have to sit with our discomfort for this for a moment. I looked this up under New York State law, and she avoids the term herself. She says each woman gets to come up with her own term, but she's very explicit about what she described, and she has two, not eyewitnesses, but people to whom she contemporaneously confided that this happened to her, going on the record about that this week. What she is alleging is rape under New York state law, and there is no statute of limitation for rape. You have the president of the United States accused by a credible journalist of having raped her very clearly in this account. Why is this? I understand that in some ways, you know, the president went through so many things that it's almost as though, well, this is just another thing, and either you buy into him or you don't. But this is like a real felony we're talking about here, and it comports actually with the tape that we heard of the president before he was elected, pulled from Access Hollywood, right? In terms of if you're a politician, you can just grab for people and take what you want. Although he said so in more explicit terms. How do you wrap your head around this particular allegation, Pierre, after all the things you've covered and all the presidents you've covered?
Well, it's you know, delicate. It's difficult. It's a situation where if what she described is true, is, you know, it's an extraordinary crime that could have been committed. The issue will be for federal and state probably state in this case, investigators to look at the whole statute of limitations issue, define it, and decide whether it's a case that can be investigated or not. You know, suffice it to say, you know, women who have or who claim that they have been assaulted, that these allegations need to be taken seriously. And that, you know, it's not something that should be shrugged off.
I want to move now to the world stage. The president is off at the G20. And at that point, two things that come that are kind of amazing. You saw that the president was asked about Russia, I think, and the question of interference, Jack Beatty. And he basically turned to Putin there and he said, naughty, naughty. And then the AP is reporting that the Kremlin says that President Putin has invited Trump to visit Russia next year, that Putin's spokesman Dmitry Peskov told reporters that the Russian leader wants Trump to attend festivities marking the 75th anniversary of the World War II victory. Russia, of course, was an ally of the U.S. in that. Peskov says Trump reacted positively to the invitation at the meeting of the summit in Osaka, Japan. Jack Beatty, what do you make of Trump's presence and demeanor and handling of himself at this meeting of the G20?
Well, again, the question is, what does Putin have on Mr. Trump? What could possibly dictate his obsequious behavior toward the Russian dictator, I would say. And, you know, this is history repeating itself. There was talk in the 2016 campaign, enthusiastic talk by his campaign aides to send have Trump go to Russia, you know, in the summer of 2016. If he thinks that's going to help him going to Russia during a presidential campaign, well, if it does help him, then it shows that essentially even hawkish Republican voters are so against the Democrats that they'll even vote for someone who looks to be compromised by the Russian leader. There is no I have seen no rational explanation of his continual effort to appease. That's the only word we can use, Vladimir Putin.
Jack, can I just ever so briefly push back? I mean, why wouldn't it be reasonable or at least plausible to say this is a guy who kind of loves autocratic rhetoric. The president seems to be very fond of Duterte over in the Philippines and Erdogan in Turkey and other places where people express strong ownership over the laws, often over what the laws are actually intending to do. Why couldn't it be that he just kind of likes what Putin projects as well as having had business interests in Russia as opposed to somebody has something to blackmail him on?
Well, it could well be. But we do know that during the 2016 campaign, the Trump people, Michael Cohen notably, were working on a deal to build a Trump Tower in Moscow while the campaign was going on. He didn't tell Republican voters. He denied this. And the president did, the candidate did. And so we know that, that essentially Russia could have at any time up to the point where we just learned this year that these negotiations on Trump Tower had gone on for months. At any time, Russia could have used that leverage over him. That was compromise. They could have said, you know, Republican voters, the president lied to you. He was trying to do a business deal with us while he was denying it to you. That's compromise. And we don't know what else is there.
Before we close out, I want to talk a little bit about the tensions with Iran, which have been coming to a boil, the U.S. accusing Iran of targeting tankers, Iran accusing the U.S. of behaving irrationally. The president, Hassan Rouhani, criticized the White House Tuesday after Trump's plans to impose new sanctions on Iran's supreme leader and other senior officials.
They do strange things that no sane person in the history of world politics has done, or at least I don't remember. This is because of their total confusion. The White House is suffering from mental disability.
We're hearing Rouhan's comments through a translator there. Ginger Gibson, what's the state of play?
Well, I'm not sure that there have not been other irrational leaders in the world. We could probably find quite a few in history and in modern times. But there is a brewing tension, and we see a tension inside the White House. You know, President Trump doesn't have a rigid philosophical approach to governing, not a real rigid ideology. But we know he was a man who didn't want to go to Vietnam, who was critical of war and has been critical of war since then, who is now surrounded by hawks. And I think we're seeing that internal White House tension play out and how they're handling this. There is a bit of a divided message, this sense that we need to push back, that there are these sanctions, that the U.S. should be stronger in how it responds to Iran. Coupled with a president who's clearly signaling that he has no appetite for any type of military engagement. And while that might be confusing signals, I think the confusion greater is two countries that aren't really talking to each other and don't have good relations now being pushed to the precipice.
The AP reporting that a Chinese official says Iran has sent a loud and clear message that it will stay in the nuclear agreement with world powers after a meeting with the signatories other than the U.S., which pulled out, of course, under Trump. Jack Beatty, very briefly, last word to you.
Well, the president's policies have led us to the knife edge of war in the Persian Gulf. And, you know, it was Woodrow Wilson who spoke to the danger of this kind of accidental war. In 1916, his campaign slogan was, "He kept us out of war." Wilson saw that on a banner and he said, "Gee, any damn German second lieutenant could throw us into war tomorrow with a torpedo." In the event, it was the German government. But the point is, an accident, an intemperate or even, you know, fanatic boat driver in the Persian Gulf can get us into war tomorrow. The president has put us in that position.
An insight from 1916 driving us in 2019. You've been hearing from Pierre Thomas of ABC News. Thanks so much. Ginger Gibson of Reuters. And, of course, our own news analyst here at On Point, Jack Beatty. Jack, have a great weekend. You can continue the conversation and get the podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. Me, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices. And they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.